Maxine Han Kingston has written eloquently and movingly about Chinese Americans. Her first memoir, The Woman Warrior, won the 1976 National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. It was about her childhood, growing up in the laundry run by her immigrant parents. Her mother tried to tell her about the world through family legends about ancestors and ghosts. Kingston has written, "Those of us in the first American generations have had to figure out how the invisible world the emigrants built around our childhoods fits in solid America." Maxine Han Kingston's second book, China Men, was about the men of her family who left China for America. It won the American Book Award for General Nonfiction in 1981. Kingston's new book, Tripmaster Monkey, is her first novel. It's set in San Francisco in the 60s, and it's the story of a 23-year-old Berkeley graduate and playwright named Whitman Ah Sing. Throughout the book, he keeps up a running commentary on everything he's read, from Rilke to Kerouac, on the movies he's seen, and on the records he's listening to, and what they say to him as a Chinese American. Kingston told me why, after two memoirs, she wrote a novel.
Well, this is what came to me, and I wasn't thinking about genre at all. It was that this character, Whitman Ah Sing, came to me in my imagination, and I found that I was talking to him, imagining him, arguing with him, and he came to me in dreams, and I followed him around, trying to think of what actions he might create, what kind of a life he might have, and so it's a novel because there is this fascinating person, but he's not a real person.
This person is so different from you are. I was really surprised when I started reading your book. Well, yeah. I think so, yeah, in the sense that, one, he's a man and you're a woman. He's fifth generation Chinese-American.
Yes.
You're first. First generation born in America. He's from a kind of showbiz background.
Yes.
Mother in the Floradora girls. And you're not. It seems to me that you chose someone with a really different kind of voice and background from yours.
Yeah, but in many ways the same. I do have people in my family that are in show business, and and when I think of gambling houses, that's in show business. And Whitman is a young person in the 60s, and I was too. And he's an English major who created himself and his life by reading, and I did that also. Part of him, even though in some ways he doesn't seem like me, his language is my language. After writing those other two books, I had a desire to work in a language where I wasn't translating other people from Chinese into English, and trying to find a language of that would beautifully show the people actually speaking in Chinese, and Whitman is speaking the most current American language I could find, and in that sense, he's me. He has my education. He has my language.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up his language, because I want you to read a section that I think will show something about the language he speaks and the language that he likes and wants. And this is from early on in the book.
Yeah, this is Whitman Ah Sing and a girlfriend, and they're walking through Chinatown. And he's thinking, is this it? I mean, what is Chinese-American culture? Do we have any culture? What theater do we have besides beauty contests? Do we have a culture that's not these knick-knacks we sell to the Bakwai? If Chinese-American culture is not knick-knackatory, look at it. Back-scratchers, swizzle sticks, pointed chopsticks for the hair, Jade East aftershave in a Buddha-shaped bottle, the head screws off and you pour lotion out of its neck. Then what is it? No other people sell out their streets like this. Tourists can't buy up J-Town. Wait a goddamn minute. We don't make Jade East. It's one of your Hakujin products by Swank. Would we do that to you? Make Jesus on the cross bottles, so every morning all over the country, hairy men twist his head off and pour this green stuff out of his neck? So what do we have in the way of a culture besides Chinese hand laundries? You might make a joke on that, something about what's the difference between a Chinese hand laundry and a French laundry. Where's our jazz? Where's our blues? Where's our ain't taking no shit from nobody's street-strutting language? I want so bad to be the first bad jazz China man, blues man of America. Of all the music on the airwaves, there's one syllable that sounds like ours. It's in that song by the Coasters. It'll take an ocean of calamine lotion, poison ivy. No, not the ivy part. It's where they sing around. Right there. That's a Chinese opera run. A Coaster must have been among those black guys you see at the Chinese movies and at dojos seeking kung fu power.
Now, you said that this character's voice was a lot like yours. In the 60s, were you thinking, where's our jazz, where's our blues, where's our street-strutting language?
Yeah, I was thinking, how are we Chinese Americans part of all this? And I was also, in a wider way, I picked this period that it's the 60s that's before the hippies. It's before the hippies and yippies. It's sort of the dark time after the beatniks and before the hippies. And that was a crucial period. Where are we going? What is the next art that that we are going to create?
You know, the voice that you have the character speaking in is this really macho swagger kind of voice.
Yeah.
Where language is style and there's this boldness in it. And I think back to your book, your first book, The Woman Warrior, and talking about how you really hated school because you had to speak.
Yeah.
And you had a small voice and you hated to speak.
Yeah.
And you still speak pretty quietly, I have to say, hearing you speak now.
Yeah, it's been a lifelong struggle to find the voice of the writer and also to find voice as a human being and all kinds of voices, political voice, the bravery to speak up, the ability to create myself as a person. All of that has to do with finding voice.
Do you have a different voice in your mind than you do vocally?
No, it's pretty much the same one.
Okay.
Yeah. Although as I read this, I remember that one language habit that I bring back, that I bring from the 60s. You know, I chose this period also because I love the language that was being formed. I mean, these words that people were inventing in order to describe new psychedelic states and visions for the new society, words that would describe the Zen gestures to bring about civil rights and to bring about the end of the war in Vietnam, all these flower power words. I mean, I wanted to write about that period because of the language of the time. And And I see that the words that I still use are, I mean, I look at something and I just say, oh, wow. I mean, I think people have forgotten now that people used to say that all the time. Oh, wow. And beautiful.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Maxine Hung Kingston, who's written a new novel called Tripmaster Monkey. I'm thinking back again to The Woman Warrior, where you wrote that you had to change your voice to be American feminine.
Mm-hmm.
What was the difference between the Chinese female voice and the American feminine voice in your mind?
Well, what I was thinking about there is that the women around me, my mother and people of her generation, the
people who came from the peasant villages of China and then came to America and worked in the fields in the San Joaquin Valley. I mean, these women have such strong voices. They shout. They don't have social shame. You know, they can go into a library or any elegant place, and they unself-consciously yell at one another. And they don't think of it as yelling. It's just good, strong, loud peasant talking and communication. And in comparison, I could see that American women who are feminine have soft, sweet, nice, quiet voices. And I was wondering, well, how can I speak? If I speak like my mother, then it's so unattractive. But if I speak softly, like the American girls that I saw around me, then it's not loud enough. It's not powerful enough. So how do I speak? So that was the problem I was wrestling with in that book and at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, one more thing on the subject of speaking. You also tell the story of how when you were a baby, your mother cut the frenum, which is that little string-like muscle that connects the tongue to your mouth.
Yeah, so she says that she did that, yeah.
She says that she did it to loosen your tongue and so that you could speak in any language.
Yeah.
Now, you were very young, if this indeed really happened. You don't remember it happening.
I sort of remember, and I think it might have been because she might have done it to another one of the kids. So I sort of remember seeing it, but I don't know.
To me, it's this incredible image of metaphor and reality really mixing. You know, it's a nice metaphor to like loosen somebody's tongue, but to do it in reality by slicing into it.
I actually think she did it in reality because my mother is, while a very imaginative woman, she's also entirely real, and she's very good at bringing dream and vision into reality, creating reality.
When she told you that she'd done that, what was your first reaction?
I had a lot of paranoid feelings, too. I thought, what if she made a mistake and she cut my tongue and then I can't speak? What if that happened? What if the results of that backfires? And maybe that's why I don't speak well.
And is this the kind of thing you could actually talk with her about?
Sometimes, very indirectly, or when I feel very brave, I'll bring up something. Or just recently, I asked her, maybe it wasn't even me, but sometimes I get a lot of backup now from my sisters and from the nieces, and who are, now they're like second, third generation Americans, and these nieces read my books, and then they get very curious, and they want to go over to Grandma, and they want to know. There were a bunch of them, and they were saying, this ghost that sat on your chest, I mean, did that happen? What was it like? And then my mother says, then she gets right away, she goes into her talk story, and she tells them about how it sat on her chest. It was so hairy, and she says, and there was this foot sticking out of it. And I'm thinking, well, why didn't she tell me there was a foot? Then I could have gotten it into the book. See, she still keeps remembering details or making it up or whatever, but there's this constant change and aliveness.
Do you ever think in the back of your mind that your mother cutting that part of your tongue really did loosen it up and it helped you write?
Yes. yes, maybe it does work that way. And actually, when I see the results, I do think that I have a very loose tongue. I can't keep secrets. I mean, she tells me, don't tell, and then I tell everything. So I guess I have done that, yes.
You grew up with your mother doing talk story. Would you explain what that is?
Well, it's a Chinese cultural tradition that I imagine goes back to pre-literate times when people passed on culture and ideas and philosophy and how to do things by putting them into stories. And I think the form is so wonderful because every time you tell a story, the story changes. The same person can tell the same story, and each time it's different because you look at the child, you look at the person that you're talking to for cues. What do they need right now? Do they need a scary story, a story of that would admonish them? Do they need a rite of passage story? Do they need a soothing story? And the story changes moment by moment as you look into the other person's face. These are the stories that became the basis for Three Kingdoms, for Monkey, and for all those Chinese novels and operas. First, they were talk story. There are modern ones, and they are also, you come home from work and you tell the story of what happened to you today. Talk story keeps a community together. My parents, the laundry, you know, people would come in with letters from professional letter writers in China. They read them aloud. This is the community, knowing one another's business. And Talk Story keeps a community alive.
Do you see your books as an extension of Talk Story?
Yes, yes. I had to work very hard to find literary ways to replicate the variousness, the many voices of Talk Story, the way the story can change from telling to telling. I've tried to find literary ways to not freeze the stories. So I found various ways of telling four versions at once, telling the long version and the short version. And having personalities, telling the same story from various personalities and seeing how it comes out. And so I think I feel successful sometimes in being able to get some of the qualities of Talk Story, even though I'm a writer.
Growing up, you really felt that in Chinese culture, girl babies and girls weren't valued in the same way that boy babies and boys were, and you rebelled against that in several ways, and mm-hmm. rebelled against the expectations for girls. You didn't want to be a slave or a wife.
So yes.
You learned to cook badly intentionally. You used to crack dishes sometimes when you'd be forced to wash them.
Yeah.
And we talked earlier about how you were kind of torn between like being a Chinese woman and American feminine, and what the requirements of each were. What was it like for you when you were exposed to feminism and there was a kind of third alternative of what a woman could be?
Actually, there was an alternative from the beginning, which I didn't recognize until I became stronger and wiser. Because at the same time that my mother would talk story about the conditions of slavery in China, she all along was giving me the chant of Fa Muklan, the woman warrior. I mean, this was one of the ways I learned to talk. I was chanting the chant of the woman warrior. And so all along she was saying, there is this other way to be, of being very masculine, of going into battle and fulfilling filial obligations by taking your father's place in battle. You could almost be a man. There's a history of swordswomen in China. And actually, we were going to the kung fu movies all the time, where it's always Angela Mao that wins in the Bruce Lee movies. And Bruce Lee loses battles once in a while, but Angela never did, and so So I had that all along. But and so when I came to feminism, actually, I felt that, oh, here are people who think the same way I do. It wasn't that I was exposed to new ideas. So I had to struggle to find ways to integrate all this, to find... See, I didn't like the woman warrior either. I didn't...
You mean the idea of the woman warrior? The attitude of the woman warrior?
Yeah.
What about it didn't you like?
Well, even now, sometimes I think I don't like calling that book The Woman Warrior, because as I got wiser and older, I also become more and more of a pacifist. And I was writing that book towards the beginning of the Vietnam War, and I was thinking... The ways of the sword are not the right methods. These are not the ways to bring about a better world. We've got to find other, more nonviolent Zen gestures.
You know, it interests me that with all of your interest in women and the image of the woman warrior and whether that's the image that you want to model your life on, that your last two books are about men.
Yeah. Well, you know, I see these three books as a long struggle as an artist and as a person. I started out maybe for 35 years. The only point of view that I had was the eye. I wrote the first person point of view for so long, and I began to see that. I mean, I got very unhappy and frustrated, thinking, "My God, what a selfish person! What a self-centered person and writer, and what an unskillful writer! I can't even do a third-person pronoun. I can't even do an omniscient voice. I can't even put two people in a scene as equals." So I struggled with that artistically for a long time. And there is a chapter in The Woman Warrior which I break into a third person voice and do an omniscient point of view. But then I sunk right back into the first person again by the last chapter. In China Men, that is a book that it seems as if it is about a lot of men and heroes, but it is a first person point of view. That same eye tells those stories. But you know, as I struggled along telling about those men, more and more they became real people unto themselves, and the eye begins to fade more and more into the background, and these men begin to speak for themselves. The eye becomes a listener, and then by this book, by Tripmaster Monkey, I finally learned to let everyone speak for themselves, and I actually disappears. That narrator that I started out with 40 years ago, that I disappears.
I imagine it was somewhat painful and disconcerting to your parents to watch you grow up in America without a real firsthand understanding of the culture that they were from in China, just as it is for so many immigrants who come to America and watch their children grow up in a different culture from the one they grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've watched your children grow up more assimilated than you were. At least that's what my guess would be. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what that's been like for you.
Well, I have one child.
Okay.
And a boy. And he's about Whitman Ah Sing's age. And actually, I don't think anybody assimilates. Nobody assimilates. The task is, how do you integrate very many different elements? This is a task of all of us. We all live in a multicultural America now. And how do we integrate all of its elements? I mean, how do I integrate this Chinese-American past and the life of in the 60s. How do I integrate the Vietnam War into my life? And my son, actually, he has solved this in such interesting ways. I mean, we took him to Hawaii and raised him mostly there. And here he is, a Chinese, Jewish, Portuguese, Irish, American. And I think that the more elements you have to fight, to struggle, to integrate, the more complex and interesting new personality and culture you come out with. And I see that the way he has solved it is he has become a Hawaiian, and he sings the ancient Hawaiian songs and plays the music. And that is the way they communicate in their culture. They have talk story, they have the chants, they have the hula, and they have the music. And if you do those things, you are a Hawaiian. And that makes me realize that all of this isn't done by race. It's done with culture. We communicate with communities.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us a little bit about your life. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.